Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The topic this afternoon is Christianity credible? In order to answer this question, we must first define what we mean by Christianity and what is meant by credible. By Christianity, we mean the belief that the historical Jesus of Nazareth was the divine Son of God, the Savior of the world. This implies several things. There is a theistic God. Two, divine miraculous intervention into this spatio-temporal world can and has occurred in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Three, that what Jesus Christ taught about his being the Savior of the world is true. We will attempt to define only the first two, to defend only the first two. If they are true, the latter point follows from them. Secondly, what is meant by credible? We take as a working definition of credible that, one, a belief must not involve any necessary contradictions, negative criterion. Two, that it offers sufficient evidence to establish its truth as opposed to competing views, positive criterion. Now, with these two criteria for credibility in mind, let us proceed to examine the alleged evidence in support of the two essential tenets of Christianity, namely theism and the miraculous intervention of God into human history in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. First, the credibility of theism can be measured by both criteria. All attempts to disprove a theistic God have failed. No one has shown that it is necessarily contradictory to believe that there is a God. Theism is not like believing in square circles. Theism is logically possible. There might be a God beyond this world, and it is impossible to disprove this logically. In point of fact, attempts to prove a theistic God is logically impossible have been as colossal in their failure as have been purely ontological attempts to prove that God's existence is logically necessary. Theism is neither logically impossible nor logically necessary. In fact, mere logic cannot prove existence of anything, for it is always logically possible that nothing ever existed, including God. This same logic applies to anyone who would attempt to disprove God by way of the problem of evil. The argument is circular. As one former atheist C.S. Lewis pointed out in his book Mere Christianity, the only way to prove that there is an ultimate evil or injustice in this world is to posit an ultimate standard of justice beyond this world, which is self-defeating. This ultimate norm of justice is what the theist claims God to be. Hence, one must suppose there is a God in order to prove that there is no God. And if the claim is not that the justice is ultimately, that the evil is ultimately unjust, then one might say that it is ultimately just, and hence cannot be used to prove that ultimately there is injustice in the world. In brief, God cannot be disproven by way of the problem of evil. And since the existence of God is neither logically impossible nor logically necessary, it remains to ask whether God's existence is supported by enough evidence to make it more credible than his non-existence. We offer the following evidence for the affirmative answer to this question. The evidence that makes the existence of God more credible than his non-existence. First of all, it is more credible that the world is designed than it happened by chance. The apparent order and design of the universe with the intricate adaptation of means to end is either the result of intelligent advanced planning or else it happened by sheer chance. That is, the universe with all of its regularity, orderliness, and adaptation is either a happy accident resulting from blind chance or else it is the result of an intelligent mind. That the chance alternative is unreasonable may be readily seen. First, the chance of getting a six by rolling one die is 1 in 6. The chances of getting 2 sixes with 2 dice is 1 in 36. And the chances of getting 3 is 1 in 216. Or to change the illustration, the 5 letters, W-O-R-L-D, can spell 120 different words. That is, if the letters were tossed into the air and fell in a row, the chances that they would spell the word world is 1 to 120. Now multiply this by the trillions and trillions of particles of the universe whirling in space several billions of years ago and ask yourself, what are the chances that the world would have taken a shape out of these whirling particles? Believing that the world happened by chance is like believing that Webster's unabridged dictionary resulted from an explosion in a printing shop. It is possible. course, this is logically possible, but it's highly improbable. In fact, it is unbelievable. It is incredible. A perfect bridge hand might result from tossing the deck in the air, but it's much more likely if an intelligent being is dealing with a stacked deck. Likewise, the atomic dice of the material universe give every evidence that they have been loaded by an intelligent being. A remarkable indication that the chance hypothesis is unbelievable comes from the world-famous humanist Julian Huxley in his book Evolution in Action. Huxley calculated that over the known timescale at the known rate of helpful mutations, the odds for total evolution happening by chance alone are so infinitesimal to be negligible. He writes, and I quote, 1,000 to the millionth power written out becomes a figure 1 with 3 million noughts after it. And that would take 3 large volumes of about 500 pages each just to print. He adds, quote, no one would bet on anything so improbable happening. How could anything so unlikely ever happen, you may ask? Huxley's reply is natural selection. In brief, in order to overcome the stupendous odds against life developing by pure chance, Huxley invokes a blind natural force and invests it with a kind of divine intelligence. The simple truth of the matter is that the chances for the world happening by pure chance are so unlikely that even atheists find it necessary to create their own God to explain the obvious design in nature. Secondly, either there is a God or else there is no explanation for our existence. The famous non-theistic philosopher Martin Heidegger said, the most basic philosophical question is, quote, why is there something rather than nothing at all? That is, why do I exist when I don't have to exist? My existence is not necessary, for I might not exist. But I do exist. Why then do I exist when it's not necessary that I exist? What is the ground of my existence? There are several possible answers. One might say that I am the ground of my own existence. But the atheist Jean-Paul Sartre noted that self-caused existence is impossible. To cause one's own existence, one would have to exist prior to his own existence, which is impossible. Another possibility is that my existence might be uncaused or ungrounded. But this is obviously not the case, since I am not a necessary existence. And therefore, I must be a contingent or caused existence. For as even the skeptic David Hume wrote, quote, I never asserted so absurd a proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. But that is precisely what the atheist must assert, that the universe arose without a cause. It is much more credible to believe that it arose as a result of a cause. Thirdly, either there is a God or moral obligation makes little sense. It is axiomatic that men have moral duties to one another. Moses, Jesus, Confucius, Buddha, and virtually all other moralists recognize that men are under moral obligation to do good to each other and not evil. It makes little sense to say that the Nazis were morally wrong or that Eichmann did evil to the Jews unless there is a moral law by which they are being judged. Nor does it make sense to make value judgments about civilization unless there is beyond civilization a standard of good by which it is to be measured. Likewise, praise and blame, condemnation and commendation have meaning only if there is some standard of right and wrong by which they are to be judged. It is interesting to note in this regard that atheists are often the loudest protesters when the principles of justice and human rights are being violated. This is very strange indeed if there is no moral law which is being violated. Why should men like Clifford and Huxley be so finicky about the truth if there is nothing in the world except matter and their feeble lives? Their carefulness becomes fully rational, however, if there is one to whom their dishonesty becomes disloyalty. That is, unless there is a God who lays upon us the moral obligation to follow the truth, it makes little sense to insist that one should be loyal to the truth. Secondly, not only is it credible to believe that there is a God, a theistic God, beyond this world, but if there is a theistic God, it is credible to believe the claims of Jesus Christ. Once theism has been established as credible, then the claims for Christ's divinity become meaningful, and they can be examined to see if they are truthful. This, too, involves the use of both negative and positive criteria. First of all, the miraculous intervention of Jesus Christ in history is not impossible. David Hume's articles, arguments against miracles, are answered once you have established that it is a theistic universe and established that supernatural events are possible. Secondly, Jesus Christ and the claim to be the Son of God, predictions in the Old Testament about His coming, His life, death, birth, and resurrection are firmly established by history. There is more historical evidence that Jesus Christ lived, died, and rose from the dead than any event from the ancient world. F.F. Bruce, in his book, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable?, establishes that the New Testament documents are the most reliably copied and composed documents from antiquity. What do they tell us? One.
I have to stop you at this time.
No, you only have 10 minutes.
That's only 10 minutes. I get 5 more.
10 minutes.
5 to go.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you. The New Testament documents tell us that Jesus Christ claimed to be the Son of God, that He claimed to be God Almighty in the flesh. He said, I am God, I can forgive your sins, I can raise the dead, I will judge all men, I was eternally existing, I am the Jehovah of the Old Testament. And He said, I will verify this claim by rising from the dead. That Jesus Christ rose from the dead has been verified by more historical eyewitnesses from the contemporary period than any event from the ancient world. Over 500 people saw Jesus Christ, handled Him, talked with Him, ate with Him on 8 or 9 different appearances over 40 days. They died saying, I know that He is the Son of God and has risen from the dead. No event from the ancient world has authentication such as the resurrection of Christ. Skeptic after skeptic, who with an open mind has looked at the historical evidence, has been converted to Christianity. Lord Lyttelton, Sir William Ramsay, Frank Morrison, who wrote a book, Who Moved the Stone, researched in order to disprove Christianity. In the process of his research, he was converted to Christianity because he saw the evidence for the resurrection of Christ was overwhelming. Our case in brief is this. One, there is a theistic God. It is credible. Two, miracles make sense in a theistic universe. Three, the unique miracle of Jesus Christ supports His claim to be the Son of God. And if He's the Son of God, when He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man cometh unto the Father but by me, then His claim is true. Thank you.
Scriven.
Yes. There's one slight problem about this version, which is that in the course of being invited to this, I was given a lot of warnings about how I was not under any circumstances to get off into general discussions about the nature and existence of God. And I was told, both in letters and on the phone, that the topic of the week and of this debate was to be the following, I quote the exact words, the credibility and validity of the claims of Jesus Christ. So, although there's a tremendous overlap, and you won't feel that we're talking about different subjects, I want to explain why that is what I have very specifically kept to. According to the records we possess, Christ made claims of several kinds. It's important to distinguish between these kinds of claim, because some kinds are true and others are not. One kind of claim consisted of moral assertions. These were sometimes simply repetitions of the moral doctrine of the Essenes, or of previously accepted moral teaching. But they were sometimes very sophisticated moral points that went beyond that. They were often expressed by means of parables. There is no doubt that the Christ of the Gospels is not only a subtle moralist, but a gifted moral teacher. It is a tradition which has not been very well observed by his 20th century disciples, from Bishop Robinson and Billy Graham to the popes. Not that they ignore morality, it is rather that their efforts in that direction ignore the welfare of man in the name of the dry husks of doctrine, or abandon any semblance of order or objectivity in morality, as situation ethics from Bishop Robinson would have it. But Christ was unlike some moral teachers, such as Socrates or the Buddha. He, like the prophet Muhammad, felt that he had divine inspiration for the morality, and indeed he felt that he was himself divine, the Son of God, and not just God's messenger. We might call these claims, a different type of claim, theological. They included more than just moral claims and assertions about his own divinity. For example, they included advice about how to get into the kingdom of heaven and claims about God's nature and wishes. These claims are all false. Or if you want to dispute the categorical simplicity of that flat statement, we can modify it to say that the claims are, on the best overall judgment of the evidence available, not sufficiently likely to be taken seriously once the evidence has been carefully examined. Of course, they must be taken seriously at first, because they are of the greatest possible significance. But similar claims are made by vast numbers of people, and one needs unusually good evidence to justify any special attention to them. Father Divine in the U.S. and the various gurus from the East now favoring us with their presence are only the latest in the long list of those who have attracted a following with such claims of divinity. The question is simply why most Christians think these leaders are charlatans or at best deceived, whereas they think Christ's similar claims should be taken seriously. The evidence for the truth of Christ's theological claims is of some interest, but not really as good as the evidence for Uri Geller's talents or Edgar Cayce's powers. There are two fatal flaws in the evidence for Christ's divinity or for the divine origin of Christ's actions. The first is that the written record postdates the formation of the Christian sect and is set down by leaders of that sect. There is simply no way in which one can take very seriously, I do not say that one should entirely ignore, accounts of miraculous events when they are contaminated by the clouds of memory and, it is a separate complaint, written by those whose career and self-concept is tied to the impressiveness of the stories. How seriously would one take an account of the Watergate follies if it was written by Nixon in his declining years when one had absolutely no corroborating evidence from politically neutral or alien sources? How seriously, to make the matter worse, if the account were by Ziegler, Nixon having died at an assassin's hand? And how seriously if, in addition to Nixon's innocence, Ziegler claimed that Nixon had miraculous powers? One would be more inclined to be impressed if Ziegler was an expert investigator of the paranormal, or even an experienced one. But Ziegler is the fisherman of our time, a simple peasant with the analytical powers of an ad writer. And he is hopelessly biased in favor of Nixon by virtue of his position and dependence on Nixon's favors. And if he waited 20 years to write, by which time he headed a Nixon cult, we would have a right to treat his credibility as negligible. At least in the case of Geller and Cayce, we have contemporary evidence. And we have considerable evidence from people previously skeptical about the allegations and convinced by their own personal and direct investigations. In spite of that, I will venture to say that the membership of the Parapsychological Association, the only organization of trained researchers into the alleged supernatural, would vote about 80% against the assertion that either of these individuals have any paranormal powers whatsoever, although it is widely and popularly believed that they do. Of course, Cayce, like some Christian Science practitioners, possibly Oral Roberts and certainly a great many MDs, was a master of psychosomatic medicine, and Geller is a good magician, but not one with paranormal powers. However, the problem with the credibility of Christ's divinity is so serious that even if one accepts the New Testament accounts of the miracles and resurrection as correct descriptions of what happened, they could not possibly be accepted as correct explanations of what happened. And, of course, many of Christ's theological claims were claims about the explanation of those and other events in divine terms. There are two ways one could approach the task of establishing the hopelessness of these allegations of divinity. One might look at the whole range of evidence studied by natural theology and conclude from that, as it is clear in my view that one must conclude, that there is no God of the kind that Jesus was talking about, and hence that there's no way Jesus could have been his son. In fact, the evidence is overwhelming that there aren't any gods even remotely like the God of the Gospels or the God of the Old Testament, male or female, so Jesus wasn't her son either. To take this approach would lead us too far afield at this point in the discussion. May I congratulate Dr. Geisler on having taken that approach in the time that was available, and I'll get to comment on that in a moment. Perhaps we'll have time to go after those matters in more detail in the discussion that follows this exchange. I'll be here for quite a while if you want to keep on with the discussion. I'm here to deconvert you, not just to talk at a philosophical level. The other approach to this second source of difficulty with Christ's theological claims is simpler. We can just look at the simpler explanations that immediately present themselves if we assume the Bible's descriptions of the miracles is literal, which, of course, we shouldn't do except for the purpose of argument. The naturalistic explanations of the miracles, which many skeptics have struggled so hard to make plausible, are more or less excluded by this assumption. I think they probably should be. Since they involve saying that the loaves and fishes, for example, were all there someplace all the time and so on. That, however, by no means entitles us, the exclusion of the naturalistic account, now by no means entitles us to the theistic explanations. It only entitles us to paranormal explanations, of which the most promising candidate would appear to be the assumption that Jesus was an individual with quite exceptional powers, like those of the people studied in paranormal psychology, people with powers such as the power to heal, levitate, read minds, predict the future, and so on. A set of people who, across the course of history, have been enough to generate the whole science of parapsychology, the study of just such paranormal powers. It's essential, of course, to distinguish between the probability of the theistic explanation of Jesus's actions in the light of the evidence available to Jesus and the probability in the light of the evidence available to us. I think that Jesus' explanation of his own powers, assuming they were as reported, was pretty good. Sometimes some idiot at discussions like this threatens me with the dilemma of either saying that Jesus was a liar or accepting what he said as true. Since it's pretty obvious that he wasn't much for mendacity, it hardly leaves me much choice. The problem is much simpler. There's a third alternative. It is that he made the best possible explanation of what struck him as events calling for a supernatural explanation, but that, as a matter of fact, he was wrong in making that bet. And although he did have paranormal powers, they were not divine in origin. Personally, I very much hope that the biblical accounts are more or less true, since I think the world would be a much more interesting place if some humans have such powers. I've recently seen reports from the huge Pentecostal missions to Southeast Asia that walking on the waters, turning water into wine, and the resurrection of the dead are occurring again on the island of Timor. I sincerely hope so, but a lifetime of work on the investigation of the paranormal leads me to add that the chances are almost negligible. And from the fact that wherever we can investigate such claims, the most recent nearby one would perhaps be the psychic surgeons of the Philippines, the results are negative. From that, we have to conclude that relying on partisan reports written a couple of thousand years ago by untrained observers working from memory and not direct observation is absurd. One has to conclude that the credibility of Christ's theological claims, his supernatural explanations in the usual sense of supernatural, meaning divine, is, after careful study, essentially zero. The validity of the claims, as opposed to the credibility, is best estimated from the evidence for them, which we have been considering under validity. under credibility. The two issues come to be the same issue in this case. One must conclude that the validity is also near zero. But perhaps the Christian is wrong to focus on credibility and validity. I well remember the state of shock induced in me when a distinguished Lutheran theologian, Dr. Paul Homer, once said to me, this is essentially a quote, "It isn't even important whether Jesus lived or died, let alone whether he was the Son of God and performed miracles. All that's important about the Gospels," he said, speaking as a Christian, "about the story of Jesus is that it creates the possibility of a way of life." In short, end of quote. In short, the concept of Jesus as an inspirational myth. One could do worse. Inspiration we do need. Irrationality we do not need. The moral example of Jesus, the moral precepts and parables, are impressive indeed. He was a man of peace, but not a coward. A man who had the courage of his convictions, but would not support a war in their name. That cannot be said of Christianity as a whole, and it can be said of very few Christians. We have much to learn from him. even if it isn't theology.
Dr. Geisler, I'd like you to start the rebuttal.
Yes, some of Christ's claims, we are told, are moral. The essential moral teaching of Christ has value. I would like to suggest that the following logical summary might be concluded from that, which would be contrary to the conclusion drawn. If Christ taught the truth, and Christ taught that he was the Son of God, then it is true that he was the Son of God. If Christ can be trusted with respect to his honesty, with respect to his morality, then it seems to me that when he is presenting a straightforward, clear, unequivocal truth, such as the truth about the inspiration of the Bible, the truth about his saviorhood of the world, and the truth about his own divinity, then what argues for the morality of Christ's claims argues for the authenticity of Christ's claims. Secondly, it seems to me that we have an entirely straw man picture that is being posed. I agree with at least 90% of what Dr. Shriven has said about parapsychology, about other so-called miracles. None of this, however, applies to the resurrection of Jesus Christ and to his claims. The differences are, one, the life, death, and resurrection of Christ was predicted by prophecies hundreds of years in advance. This is not true of the claims of any other religious leader. Two, Jesus Christ claimed to be the Son of God and proved it by his character. The great skeptics and atheists, almost without exception, have acknowledged the morality, the integrity of Jesus Christ, and if you acknowledge that, then you acknowledge the truthfulness of his character. Three, no other world religious leader, or for that matter person, has ever predicted his resurrection, which has been verified by eyewitnesses, over 500 of them, over a 40-day period of time, who personally were skeptical, not partial to believe it, with the tendency to hallucinate, but were skeptical against them. No other person has made the claims, the prophecies have been made, or proved it by the resurrection. Hence, Hume's second argument against miracles is answered in that we do not have canceling miracles supporting other claims. Thirdly, it seems to me that there is an entire misunderstanding of the authentic basis of Christianity in terms of the documents. These documents have the shortest gap from the time of the original of any book from the ancient world. The earliest copies of the New Testament come from the very first part of the second century. The usual gap for a book from antiquity is 1,000 years from time of composition. The amount of manuscripts of the New Testament are 5,000. Tacitus has 2 manuscripts. Thucydides has 8. The Peloponnesian Wars and most great classics from the ancient world survive on about a dozen manuscripts. The New Testament has more manuscripts, more accurately copied, 99.9% accurately copied compared to, let's say, Homer's Iliad, which is 95%, or the Mahabharata, which is 90% accurately copied. The New Testament is the most accurately copied, the most well-documented and authenticated book from the ancient world. I refer you again to F.F. Bruce. So we do not have this many years later, bad witnesses, poor evidence kind of support for Christianity. I would suggest also that they did not have to depend on memory. They were eyewitnesses. Virtually every writer of the gospel narratives were eyewitnesses and contemporaries of the events that occurred. So that when we say that Christianity is unique and the claims of Christ are unique, we mean historically verifiable in terms of an actual person who lived, proved by his character that what H.G. Wells said is true. I am not a believer. I am a historian, but this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irresistibly the center of history. Renan, the great skeptic, said, if the life and death of Socrates is the life and death of a sage, the life and death of Jesus Christ is the life and death of a god. And if this man was wise and godlike and moral and proved it by his character and the resurrection, then he has the right to be believed. He is credible in the claims that he presents. Thank you.
Please.
Let me pick out some points that Dr. Geisler made in his original presentation and then refer to the ones that he's just made. The first point he made was that one can't show theism to be contradictory by appealing to the existence of evil, because this would be a self-refuting argument, since it would consist in saying there are things that are evil in the world, and we know those are evil, and of course we would then have to have standards of evil in order to establish that claim, and the standards of evil presuppose the existence of God, which would show that we've already got God in order to refute this particular claim about God's existence. It's not a very promising argument. After all, it does just assume that the only possible foundation for ethics is religious, and there are, after all, in the world today, a majority of human beings who live under ethical systems which are based upon humanitarian considerations or utilitarian considerations, and which lead to very, very similar results to those that you find in the Ten Commandments or in the New Testament, and which work perfectly well as social control systems in this country as in other countries, so that one can hardly assume that they automatically are committed to the existence of God, certainly not as far as they're aware, but supposing one argued that they are really and truly, how would one make that stick? How can one show that there can't be good reasons for having a rule about driving on the left-hand side of the road, or good reasons for having a rule against the breach of contract, independent of the existence of God? There are obviously good social reasons for morality, and one doesn't need to assume God's existence. That means that the problem of evil problem remains, and does, in my view, show that God, in the strong sense usually involved in the New Testament, cannot possibly exist. The second point that he made is to say that the empirical evidence is very strong, and this is the basis for the theistic claim. The first of his arguments under that heading was the argument from design. And his presentation of it consisted in saying the choice is simply between the universe being having its present complexity as a result of mere chance, or there being some designer. If those were the only two alternatives, then his very neat little examples about dice and Webster's dictionary would indeed be relevant. Since these are not, of course, the only two alternatives, the crucial third alternative, the standard alternative, is the existence of a evolutionary process which leads to order in the long run, although beginning with random elements, then one doesn't have to face that alternative. To give a simple illustration of that, hissing is not really a contribution to the discussion. If you've got something to say, you should say it in the question period and avoid that, I think. Applause is also not a contribution to the discussion. I would say that the design issue is more like the question whether, if you took a number of small magnets, arranged them randomly on a large table, and then you shuffled them around for a couple of million years, just letting whatever happened happen, would you be really surprised to find that at the end they bonded off in pairs? No, you would not. Would you think that somebody had deliberately been doing it? No, you would not. You would think that, given those forces and the shuffling of a random kind and an initial random order, you will get order in the end. The second argument that he took up under this heading was the cosmological argument, why something rather than nothing, self-caused, is impossible according to Sartre, and therefore, I'm interested that he should quote an atheist on this crucial matter, but it seems to me clear that, again, the problem is that there's a third alternative. The third alternative, one of the obvious third alternatives, is the infinitely old universe, which would, of course, have an explanation of a physical kind for every state that there is in it. And if you don't like that, you still feel that somehow the whole thing had to come from somewhere, then, all right, it came from a piece of uncaused matter. Why should one imagine that uncaused things have to be somehow divine? They aren't any more neat as explanations when they've got extra funny properties on top of being matter. If we have to swallow the idea of an uncaused cause, let's make it as simple a thing as possible. Let's at least make it something that we understand in other respects. The third argument he gave is one I've already discussed, the argument from ethics. There can't be a standard of right and wrong and justice or a standard of truth unless there is a God, and to that I would reply by saying this. Obvious pragmatic alternatives to that. Then he turned to the question of Christ's divinity and the historical evidence, and he says the best evidence for any event in the ancient world and so on. Two things, very important points to make about this. First of all, the crucial fact about it is that it isn't an event which had a reasonable antecedent likelihood. Supposing we find records written down long after the event that say that the Battle of Thermopylae involved a large number of people on one side and a large number of people on the other side, and that it was won by the people on one side. Well, it had to be won by somebody, or perhaps I suppose they could have both lost. You're not too surprised about that. There isn't an initial antecedent unlikelihood that has to be overcome by exceptional testimony. That is the problem with the evidence for the divinity of Christ. We're not trying to establish that there was such an entity as Christ. We're trying to establish an extremely peculiar, extremely antecedently unlikely explanation of what he did. And for that, you need better evidence than the kind of thing that you have of these ancient records. May well be the evidence here was better. But one may have to distinguish between the situation with contemporary paranormal phenomena, where the people can go in and look now, record now, state what they see now. It can then be questioned, and you can go back to the source for a further look. However many eyewitnesses there were in those days, they didn't get the record down for a long time. We do not have independent records. There was no possibility of going back to look again after thoughts had come to your mind about possible explanations. Although they were eyewitnesses, they did rely on memory. Those two are not mutually exclusive. It's 20 years at least before the first written record went down, and after that we've got a lot of other trouble. One final comment on his second remark. He said that, I think I've covered most of them in this discussion, the first ones, he said that the special feature of the Christian situation, Christ's divinity, is the uniqueness of it, the prediction of it by predecessors of Christ and the predictions by Christ of his own resurrection and so on. I don't think one wants to act as if somehow the fact that something is predicted is automatically makes it divine or more likely to be divine. It might be more divine as a result of being unpredictable. It's important that events which intervene in an unpredictable way in the universe are rightly thought to be candidates for divine acts of God than those which are simply predictable. After all the prophets predicted great natural events. One's not inclined to think that they were supernatural as a result of that. Finally, I'd like to just comment on his statement that a great many, I think he really suggested most of the skeptics who have looked at the stuff, the evidence, what's available, the arguments and so on, have been persuaded. I stand here to deny that, not only on my own behalf, but also in the following statement. If you take people who have studied it, the people who teach theology at schools of theology, including my distinguished colleague here, and if you take professors of philosophy that have spent some time on the philosophy of religion and on natural theology, you will, if head counting is your bag, find that most of them think that you cannot show there is a God.
Thank you. Now, I think I would have about 10 minutes left, and I would like to ask if anybody from the audience would want to question our guests?
I would like to add that I was asked if I could be available for 3 hours. I am available for 3 hours. I'll be here.
Will you start, please?
I'd like to ask a question to Dr. Kirby. Concerning the testimony of the religious leaders and the first century of Christianity, you said that they, that their sort of livelihood or their whole profession as religious leaders sort of depended upon them promulgating this theory that Jesus Christ was indeed God. Would this be a sensible thing for them to do, seeing that it led to
I suppose it's about as sensible or as nonsensical as that of any persecuted minority who seeks to prosecute, to voice abroad their case in as strong a way as they can put it.
So it wouldn't be a lie they were going to.
I wish you'd get out of your head the idea that the alternatives are lying and being right. There is also the possibility of being wrong, but not lying. That's the one that I'm interested in.
Thank you.
It seems to me, Dr. Geiger has come up with exact facts related to his stand, which is self-concerned. He seems to generalize. Can you explain why you have taken this stand?
I haven't. If you want to explain it a little better, then have another.
Another try.
Well, I'll leave that. I think you've answered my question. And if you answer me this one, I think I would like to have both of you answer this one. What do you believe personally, let's say in generalized thing or specific thing, that God, atheism, and life itself?
I'll let you start that one, Archer.
Well, the first two, I think we were talking about God and atheism, so I don't think we need to repeat that. The third one on life itself, I feel that Jesus Christ is the point in human history where God comes to focus and makes sense in tangible, relevant terms. And I find the meaning of life in Jesus Christ. With the Apostle Paul, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And if great atheists such as Bertrand Russell would say that what the world needs now is Christian love, I just like to say yes, but you can't have it without Christ.
What I believe in is the reality of the pains and tribulations and hopes and joys and achievements of man today, and the fact that we better damn well solve them in our own name or they won't get solved.
My question is, anybody who knows the answer can answer. Were the Gospels compiled from diaries that were compiled during the life of Christ or after the death of Christ? And had we realized the time they wrote down everything that happened? Were the day-to-day accounts?
Two answers.
The Gospels were recorded by eyewitnesses who took written documents of the day-to-day accounts and compiled them during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses who were the contemporaries of Christ. Matthew was a tax collector who was used to taking records. He took the long discourse records of Christ. Luke built his account on eyewitness written accounts. They were written by the contemporaries of Christ who had eyewitness day-to-day observation, wrote them down, and compiled them within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. We have no original manuscripts of the New Testament, nor do we have any original manuscripts of the other books from antiquity, but we have more copies, earlier copies, better copies of the Bible than any other book from the ancient world.
I'll accept that. Speak for yourself.
I think our guest has answered your question.
A lot of people believe in God because of something that happened 10,000 years ago, and that's what we're here to discuss.
Should I comment on that too?
Should I comment briefly on that question too?
I think it's very important what happened 2,000 years ago because that's the only point in human history that God entered the spatio-temporal world in the person of a human who lived among us. And I do think it's very important what happens today. But unfortunately, to simply believe without historical or rational evidence seems to me to be a classic example of what Socrates said would be the unexamined life. And I believe that the unexamined life is not worth living and the unexamined faith is not worth believing.
I read the situation when there was an earthquake in California, and a number of non-believing people, their children are still being sent to education just to hysterical with their parents in the 80s. By contrast, this man and her family woke up praising God. That's what I mean by me. Now, the question I I'm also on eternal life issues of Christ. If you seek in Bergman, they will not have this peace or this eternal life. And furthermore, Jesus says those who reject them will be sent into hell. And then here's the question. What do you have to offer should I reject Christ? And secondly, if there's one chance in ten in the hell, is it worth taking that chance?
Against that offer, I've got something very dull to offer you. It is reality and responsibility and no stories.
Thank you.
And on the second question, what if there's one chance in hell, in ten of there being a hell, why should you take the chance? If you think God is stupid enough to think that if that's your reason for being good, he's going to keep you out of the place, then you're very stupid.
To the left.
Dr. In contemporary atheism right now, we have two positions held by Dr. Scrivener at home state, which my wife and some of your work, Dr. Scrivener, on the basis of the different truths of God existence. God existence, like Cosmos, Marvel, Cosmos, etc. And the very fact that these arguments do not work, there is a very thorough probability of there being a God. We should be creating it. However, at present, it should be mentioned that there's a very stronger atheistic position held right now by people like Anthony Flew and many of the doctors in our own department of philosophy here that hold this whole concept.
Excuse me, would you go directly to the question? Would you address the question?
Could you make a few comments on the contemporary linguistic analysis position in regard to religion?
The contemporary linguistic analytic position, which stems from Hume's distinction of two kinds of propositions and came through the early logical positivist principle of verifiability, such as air, that only empirical propositions plus tautologies are meaningful, has proven to either be too narrow or too broad. On the one hand, if it's too narrow, it defeats itself. It's a self-defeating thing, such as Ayer's verifiability principle. Itself could not be empirically verified, so it was self-stultifying. On the other hand, if you open it up and make a third class of propositions, which are meaningful, then while you push meaningful religious statements out the front door in the name of your criterion of meaning, you sneak them in the back door in the name of the third status which you allow for your own principle. So what's happened, in effect, is that there is no way, really, to deny the meaningfulness of transcendent statements without making one, so that the whole school itself is a self-stultifying attempt to eliminate God.
I've been requested at this time, if you have a card in your hand, if you want to write down the decision of this debate, and if you have further questions, please indicate on the card, and we'll go to the microphone to the left.
Pull it down a bit. Right.
The relationship between proof and belief, I said very quickly in my opening paragraph, was that in order for a belief to be credible, it must have two criteria, one a negative one. It cannot involve a necessary contradiction, and a positive one, namely that it has to have probable evidence in support of it. So I think that no belief is credible unless it is a non-contradictory belief that has supporting evidence as opposed to the competing beliefs. And I tried to offer for you what I thought were the unique, more probable evidences for theism and for Christianity over the alternate positions.
Dr. Scribner, what would you accept as evidence of
the existence of God? Evidence of interventions into the normal course of events which meet two conditions. One, that they are not explicable, even remotely explicable, by any kind of hypothesis of the usual natural kind. And secondly, that they show signs of some plan connected with a moral set of moral principles.
That is true to the extent of your point of having
unrelated magnets floating around in space, and finally getting together, I would feel willing to consider that theory if you can explain what caused or who caused the action to get those two together.
Let me stress to you the hopelessness of this line of reasoning by, in spite of its charm, by having you look carefully at what it is that you think it points towards. What you think it points towards is the necessity for introducing some designer who arranged all these things in advance. I ask you this question: how do you explain the occurrence of the designer? Supposing you think that is a satisfactory solution. You got there only by insisting that there have to be explanations. Very well, what is the explanation of the designer? Who made God?
If you could explain the basis and the total existence of the universe, then you could truly explain what God is and what he is like, and if he really exists. However, I don't have enough knowledge to explain the universe, but I do believe in one thing, that there is an essence to this entire life that we have here, the entire life of the universe. It did not begin with an inanimate object or element, but there had to be a beginning sometime, a beginning that had a life to it and caused life in other things.
You made your point. Biographically interesting, theologically trivial.
Thank you. You have made your point.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that both of you could briefly on what they believe on the life after death. And when we study the Bible, much is said about there being a life after death here on earth. And I was wondering if you had something to say about it.
Q1.
Granted the credibility of belief in God and the divinity of Jesus Christ, immortality follows, because Jesus Christ, by the resurrection, brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. He proved that he had a pre-existence and a post-existence, and he made the reversal of death possible. The entire course of events in this world, as someone said, let not the H-bomb be the sequel in which all men are cremated equal. The only hope for that is Jesus Christ, who reversed death and decay and brought immortality to light. And without his resurrection and the theistic God of Scripture, there really is no hope for immortality.
Even if one was to accept that line of argument, it seems to me rather awkwardly to establish only the existence of immortality for Christ, who's rather different from us. But I'm not really quite satisfied by the argument as a whole. I've spent some 25 years looking at evidence both past and present for immortality. I keep being hopeful, but I have to report that as it stands, the evidence is terrible.
Well, Dr. Sheridan, what do you believe what do you feel happens to a person
when
his journey on
his leg
is completed?
He rots.
Thank you. Mike to the right.
Well, the argument goes like this. You either get fairly fancy about your idea of God, or you get very modest. If you're sort of Zeus-oriented, then there's no problem about evil, because Zeus was full of it, and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday he was off raping somebody or other, and Tuesday and Thursday he was doing good works. So there's no problem of evil if you have a sufficiently evil God. But if you go for a God somewhat like the one Dr. Geisler was talking about, the God of the New Testament as it's normally conceived, then the problem is that he has both the power to eliminate evil, and he appears to have the motivation to do it in at least many cases where it cannot be prevented by mankind, owing to physical incapacity or lack of knowledge, but he does not. That is, enormous, savage wars occur in which innocent children are killed on a huge scale and so on. Well, it would take us a long time to rehearse the whole history of the moves and countermoves about that, and I think you understand quite clearly the two positions that we hold. My position is that The standard escape clause, which is God moves in inscrutable ways his wonders to perform, is nice, except that by that time you have unfortunately removed any possibility of comprehending the will of God. If you do know what the will of God is, if you do, for example, have commandments that you believe express his moral will, then you have standards for judgment that come from him. And by those very standards, you are forced to the conclusion that unnecessary evil occurs. Therefore, he's either not powerful or not good.
I'll have recognized two more questions. Would you go to the...
I'd like to address this question. Yeah. I think that you mentioned that the gospel were written by eyewitnesses. Now, I've heard the teaching, I've also heard that they were written from eyewitness accounts or from stories gathered by the gospel where they were not committed to be. What's
true? Matthew was an eyewitness disciple of Christ. He wrote the Gospel of Matthew. John was an eyewitness disciple of Christ. He wrote the Gospel of John. Mark was an associate of the Apostle Peter, the young man in the garden. He was an eyewitness, and so was the man for whom he was the secretary. Luke was not personally a disciple of Christ, but in the first paragraph says that he looked into written eyewitness accounts and recorded his gospel. Of the four gospels, three are direct eyewitnesses. The fourth is an eyewitness written accounts. Yes, John was the youngest disciple of Christ.
I think we have to be very young. His gospel materialized.
Pardon me?
His gospel materialized. Wasn't
it no, William F. Albright, who perhaps is the world's outstanding paleographer, an archaeologist said every book of the New Testament was written by a baptized Jew by 75 A.D.
I think our guest has answered your question.
Can I add a footnote? Yes. I want to add a word because this business of the eyewitness account has become so important.
Excuse me. I would like to have said many things many times when you were asked questions and did not reply, so I think we ought to keep the same format.
Thank you, madam, for your statement. At this time, I have to cut off because we passed the time, but as Dr. Scriven has mentioned, and I'm sure Dr. Geisler would be open for questionings later on, if anyone of you would like to meet him or meet them,
yeah,
I'd be glad. And at this time, I'm pretty sure that all of us would join with me in expressing our gratitude in having two of them coming up to Canada and give us an enlightening talk about the claims of Jesus Christ. Who is this man? And I'm pretty sure that all of you have heard, and it's up to you now to make the decision. Thank you.
Committee.
I told you about them, and
I think we should. Let me say something which may make it unnecessary for you to elaborate this choice any further. It's absolutely wrong to suggest that everybody that is deceived is a paranoid schizophrenic. Christ wasn't anything like a paranoid schizophrenic. I encounter in the course of my parapsychological research countless hundreds of people who believe that they have supernatural powers and are wrong. They're not paranoid schizophrenics at all. They're people that have automatic writing skills. They're people that believe they can read cards and so on. These days, thinking that your God is viewed as being a little peculiar, but there are still plenty of people who do it, aren't paranoid schizophrenics. It's much more an indicator of that now than it was then. But in those days, I mean, there were many prophets who believed that they were divine. And in less fancy versions of civilization than our own, there are still many. So every witch doctor believes that he has divine powers, is part of the God system.
Yes, I'd like to comment on that. I don't think perhaps putting it in terms of the alternatives, Lord, liar, and lunatic, are the most intelligible ways to present this. Either Jesus Christ was telling the truth when he claimed to be God and therefore was God, or he was not telling the truth
right, and
was not God. Now, if he was not telling the truth, it's for one of two reasons. Either he knew he wasn't God and he was intentionally deceiving people, in which case then he's not even worthy to be followed as a moral example because he's a great moral prevaricator, or he did not know that he wasn't God but thought he was. Now, in this case, we need not call the person a lunatic or paranoid, but I think we have to say if Jesus Christ was not right about his own identity, and if self-knowledge and self-love and self-understanding is a key to the understanding and love of others, which is also a well-established psychological point, then at that point I'd have to say I couldn't trust Jesus Christ either. So either he is completely untrustworthy, or he is the Son of God. So anyone who would like to say he is a good moral example, he is a trustworthy person, must follow the logic that Jesus himself presented to the rich young ruler who said, "Good master, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said, there is none good but God. Are you calling me God, or are you saying that I am a mere human teacher? If I am a teacher, I'm a bad one. If I am a good teacher, I'm God. So either he was a good God or a bad man. There's no third alternative between them.
That sounds... Can I react to that?
Yes.
That's pretty fancy stuff. Are you really saying that if he's wrong about some things, he has to be wrong about everything you said?
I would say if he's wrong about the essential things, he could not be trusted. And if a man is wrong about his own identity, if a man is wrong about the most essential, closest knowledge he has, the knowledge of his own self, I'm certainly not going to accept his knowledge about me or the world as a whole or some other world.
It's an extraordinary view that if somebody is wrong about their own nature, they can't be nice to their kids. They can't be recommending things to do with kids that are true. They can't be good educators.
I don't think that's extraordinary at all. I think it's been proven. Erich Fromm, for example, shows that it's impossible to love others unless you love yourself, that acceptance of others is dependent upon a self-acceptance. And if one doesn't have self-acceptance, which is built on know yourself, self-understanding, he can't possibly be able to accept and understand other people.
Well, I find it puzzling that Muhammad, who thought he was pretty divine, should have said so many good things in ethics. I just think they are pretty good things, and he was right about them, and he said them pretty well in a lot of cases, but I don't accept his account of his own divinity. Is that really hard for you to manage?
I think it's not hard to imagine, but in the case of Christ, when the essential claims about his deity and his morality are essentially connected, it makes it incumbent upon us to take the conclusion that if he's not right about his central claims, that we cannot follow the conclusions from those central claims. They may follow accidentally or trivially, but that, of course, is not what an intelligent, critical person would want to do.
Gentlemen, we better have another question.
I was saying something very simple. When you try to decide relied on historical data whether an alleged event occurred. You look at two considerations. One is the reliability of the witnesses and their knowledge of the event and were they witnesses and so on. And the other is the nature of the claim that they're making. If they bear witness to the fact that Magna Carta was signed in a field near Runnymede, you say to yourself, well, I mean, is there any reason not to accept this? Should be a little nervous about this. You can be willing to accept that without much difficulty. Now, supposing they say that Magna Carta was signed while floating 16 feet off the earth on a Turkish carpet, then you say, well, now I need to look very carefully at these guys. I mean, were they there, and do we have the notes from the time that they were there, and so on and so on. That's the point. And in the case of a divine claim, it's just not very hopeful to rely on the sort of evidence that might document an ordinary historical claim.
I should think that anything that would verify the integrity and morality of the person making the claim would tend to verify the claim that he's making. This is certainly the procedure we use in the law of court, and I don't see why we should rule Christ out of court. If Jesus Christ was an honest person, if he told the truth, and one of the truths that he told was that he was the Son of God, then it is true that he was the Son of God. Let us be frank and admit, as the people who didn't believe him in his day, that if he was not telling the truth, he was born of fornication, he was an evil man from an evil background, and let's not come up with patronizing morality that he was a good teacher. That's the one option he never left open to us. Read C.S. Lewis' chapter, The Shocking Alternative. The one thing that Jesus never left open to us was to say that he was a good moral man. We must either say he's a bad man or a good God.
Yeah, but the alternatives that Jesus leaves open to us doesn't constrict us in trying to interpret as carefully as we can what he actually was. We have to be willing to look at other alternatives that he may not have considered. And in this case, that's what we do. See, I guess I'm much more used than you are to dealing with people who have claims of a bizarre kind about their own nature and powers, which I don't think they finally are able to support. But on the other hand, are excellent people and excellent in lots of ways, including moral ways. And I just don't think you can transfer from the fact that Christ's a good moral teacher to anything at all about his theology. I mean, what is he as a theologian?
On the other hand, we're committed to the person of Jesus Christ as Christians, and if his person is bizarre, immoral, self-deceived, we certainly aren't going to go through life saying that our moral paradigm, the world's great example, is a bizarre, self-deceived person. I would never commit myself to Jesus Christ if I brought that, believe that, nor should any sane being.
I agree.
Then, on the other hand, you ought to consistently say if he was moral, that you ought to commit yourself to him because he told the truth. The truth that he told was that he's the way to God and the Son of God. So either you choose and be honest like Bertrand Russell and say that Jesus wasn't even as good as Socrates, or be honest like Joseph Fletcher and say that Jesus Christ was not even literate, or you admit that he was intelligent and moral and what he said was true. We wouldn't want to confuse the failure to diagnose a disease with self-love. I would quote two eminent psychologists, one a believer and one a non-believer, on the basis of self-love. The believer in the first century is the one we're here to talk about today, who said, love your neighbor as yourself, and whose disciples said, no man ever yet hated his own self, but cherishes and nourishes it, so that self-love is the basis for neighbor love. The second psychologist is an unbeliever, and his name is Erich Fromm, who wrote a book, The Art of Loving, and Psychoanalysis and Religion, and another one on humanism, in which he says that same thing, that love of others is dependent upon love of self, in which case he's really borrowing a moral principle from Jesus Christ, incorporating it into his humanism, and claiming it as a psychological insight, when really it was really stolen from the New Testament and from the lips of Christ. I would assume that Erich Fromm is a modern psychologist.
Well, in that case, then I agree with you, but I don't agree that he would be considered a scientist.
Do you have anything to say, Dr. Scully?
I have a great deal of
pertains
to the principle of Jesus Christ, and I think that seems to be the reason of the evidence supporting his case about
Okay, I refer you to the works of Tanners, T-A-N-N-E-R-S, The Case Against Mormonism, Shadow and Reality, people who spent virtually all of their life in the Mormon Church, who now have Xerox copies of original manuscripts of Joseph Smith where the revelations were changed, contradicted hundreds of times. They have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that it is a historical fraud fraught with all kinds of contradictions and impossibilities, and this is known by the hierarchy in the Mormon Church. They are sitting on the information. All you have to do is to write Salt Lake City, the Tanners, Frank and Sandra Tanner, and read any of their books, and it's absolutely proven beyond question. I'll give you just a couple examples to prove it. When Joseph Smith translated the Book of Abraham, so-called, from Egyptian, it was believed that Egyptian would never be deciphered. It has been deciphered since then, and Joseph Smith's translation has absolutely nothing to do with the story involved. It's not the story about Abraham on an altar. It's the story about an Egyptian god. He used the same characters and letter for letter transliterated them, and this has been proven beyond doubt to be a classic fraud. Not just one or two, but hundreds upon hundreds of them, and unfortunately, the whole case rests on historical contradictions and a fraud. That is not true of Christianity, so there is no comparison whatsoever.
However, I sort of like the idea that you're faced with an immense and growing church of true believers who, as you rightly point out, have very poor documentation. I mean, if you read the stuff even with a sort of naturally skeptical eye, it's pretty hard to swallow. And yet we have this enormous church controlling an entire state and with an enormous political power in other states. I'm inclined to think that that shows a very strong will to believe. That is, a tendency to grasp at these things even if the evidence isn't very good. And that part of it, I think, transfers to Christianity.
I don't think it transfers to Christianity. I think it shows the difference between credible belief and incredible belief. And we ought to stick with the credible belief.
I agree with that.
Interesting things about the New Testament is because we have 5,000 manuscripts, we are able to verify and reproduce the original with a greater accuracy than any other book. For example, the most manuscripts of any book from the ancient world outside the Bible is Homer's Iliad, and there are 647 manuscripts, 5,000, as I said, in the New Testament. Now, in the case of Homer's Iliad, we have enough manuscripts that we can compare them and see where there were changes made and reconstruct the original to about 95%. Since there are 5,000 in the New Testament, we have the next best thing to a Xerox machine without a Xerox machine, because we can reproduce it to 99.9. That is, we're sure that the Bible in our hands today is 99.9 accurately translated from the original manuscripts, even though we don't have them or a Xerox machine. So for all practical purposes, with the little minor things like spelling and a few words here and there that does not change any essential teaching, let alone a minor teaching of Christianity, we have a New Testament Xerox machine.